Good evening. My name is Margaret Beatty, and I'm a student project manager, at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum and the Departments of English and American Studies, I'd like to welcome you to this evening's event, What's in a Best-Selling Crime Novel? Over the past 80 years, crime has become a favorite focal point of American popular culture. From novels such as The Maltese Falcon and The Talented Mr. Ripley, to The Silence of the Lambs and A Time to Kill, crime fiction has both fascinated and intrigued the masses. The genre has grown from the simple detective tale to include a vast number of different styles, including the whodunit story, the spy novel, and the hard-boiled narrative. With its immense following in mainstream society, it's easy to see why crime fiction has become so ingrained in the fabric of American popular culture. We have with us tonight Leonard Casuto, who is a professor of English at Fordham University. He is the author of Hard-Boiled Sentimentality, The Secret History of American Crime Fiction, and The Inhuman Race, The Racial Grotesque in American Literature and Culture. He is also the general editor of the forthcoming Cambridge History of the American Novel. Professor Casuto received a BA from Columbia University and an AM and PhD from Harvard University. And I just wanted to express a special and personal thank you to Professor Casuto for coming all the way down here from New York City and braving the snowpocalypse or whatever y'all are calling it. But at this time, I would like to ask that you please turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because this program is being taped and some of our audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. And now, please join me in welcoming Leonard Casuto.
Do you hear me? To the thank you, let me say you're welcome, but let me also thank all of you for coming out. I was thinking that we'd be in a seminar set up here today due to the conditions. So I'm delighted to see all of you. So let's get to it. So what is a bestseller? And what does a bestseller do? We might expect the second question to be the more complicated of these two, but really they both are. And what I'm going to do with you tonight is try to answer both of those questions, the origins and surprising complexities behind the term bestseller, and then an application, or taking some of those conclusions and applying them to the ways that crime novels have been read and understood in the United States. And I'm going to wind up focusing on the pivotal case of Raymond Chandler to consider especially what makes a best-selling crime novel. So the first thing to note is that the idea of the bestseller, despite its obvious importance to how we think about books, has received very little scholarly scrutiny over the years. Professors and other intellectuals just haven't been concerned with the idea of bestsellerness or what a bestseller is. In fact, the idea of the bestseller has gotten more attention from authors of would-be bestsellers who quarrel with the lists than with anybody who has tried to inquire seriously into those lists. In the scholarly world, books tend to be called bestsellers when people find anecdotal evidence of very high sales or hype or multiple printings and so on. There are ways to get specific figures on certain titles, typically by consulting publishers' records, and book historians have done some of that. But usually the data tend to be patchy. And usually when scholars apply the term bestseller, they do so pretty casually compared to the way that they apply other terms. So one possible reason for the scholarly indifference to bestsellers has to do with the much vaunted and inconsistently permeable boundary between so-called high and low culture. The critics, like me, represent high culture, and bestsellers are typically seen as low. But high and low culture need each other, and I think that it's worth it for us to look closely at the antagonism or perceived antagonism between them in this particular case. And in order to start doing that, I first want to bring to attention a forgotten raft of books that purported to teach inexperienced readers how to read a book. And these books started appearing in the 1870s. And they came out in great numbers in the 1870s and the 1880s. They had titles like The Best Reading, Hints on the Selection of Books. What Books Shall I Read? And How Shall I Read Them? And How to Read a Book in the Best Way. These books appeared at the same time that the American publishing industry, the book industry, swung into a new commercial gear after the Civil War. Publishers were exploring new forms of advertising and branding, and the period of what we would call the commercial book was born, a period which may now be in the process of ending. Many, although not all, of these how-to-read books grew out of the efforts of publishers to establish their own highbrow credibility and gain authority to market their wares. But they amounted to a form of marketing. They're an early example of the highbrow reaching out to the lowbrow to create an early version of the middlebrow culture that the critic and book historian Janice Radway has written about extensively. But Radway's work focuses on the 20th century, on the Book of the Month Club. This is an earlier and not as much noticed instance of a different version of middlebrow. And particularly, in contrast to the Book of the Month Club, the overarching idea of the how-to-read books was to raise literary sensibility by teaching readers how to read for something other than entertainment. The Book of the Month Club, as Radway details in great and persuasive length, was something more of a meeting in the middle. The idea of intellectual enrichment, which is common to most of the how-to-read books of the 1870s and 1880s, fit comfortably with the commodification of the idea of upward mobility and personal advancement. One of the how-to-read book authors, Charles Moore, in a book called What to Read and How to Read, he counsels readers to bear in mind that, and this is Moore, a book of real worth not only pleases during its perusal, but leaves the reader wiser and better. We can presume, I think, that that good reading habits were being commodified and put into the service of upward mobility, the wiser and better part, because middle-class people felt upward mobility to be under attack, because you don't have a defense of an idea without there already being an attack on it in the first place. And in fact, the idea of upward mobility was under a kind of threat, and upward mobility is this pretty sacred credo in American culture. It was being threatened by the rise of the first corporate bureaucracies and the predatory and often monopolistic capitalism that was rife in the United States in the decades following the Civil War. Horatio Alger novels and the how-to-read books were of a piece in that they both offered a certain kind of reassurance, a reassurance that people could get ahead if they worked hard and applied themselves. And applying themselves, the how-to-read books show us, for people to apply themselves included reading properly. So the implication was that reading bestsellers was an example of not reading properly. And that implication endures to this day. Okay, that's the backdrop. So What is a bestseller anyway? Let's talk about The Great Gatsby for a minute. Maybe two. The Great Gatsby sold 21,000 copies as a front list title in 1925. Now, the front list is when a book is current product by a bookseller. The booksellers will mark it two or three times a year, put out a new list. And they will they'll have certain featured titles, the new books. That's the front list. And they and publishers will aggressively market their front list titles. So if you write a book, you have a 3 to 6 month window. If you're writing, if you publish with a commercial publisher, you have that book has a 3 to 6 month window to establish itself and show the publisher that it's selling really well, so that the publisher might throw more money behind it. If it doesn't do well in that initial period, then chances are it's going to sort of peter out. And then after that season, when it's new, is over, then it migrates to a publisher's backlist, which is always growing. So The Great Gatsby sold 21,000 copies as a frontlist title. Big disappointment to F. Scott Fitzgerald and his publisher, Scribner. Fitzgerald's royalty was 15%, and the book sold for $2. $2. A dollar in 1925, when The Great Gatsby came out, is worth about $15 today. So The Great Gatsby was selling for the equivalent of about $30, which is about what a new hardcover might sell for today. Sometimes a little less, sometimes a little more. If Fitzgerald was making 30 cents a copy, 15% royalties on a $2 purchase price, he made $6,000 or thereabouts on The Great Gatsby. He also made another $26,000 on the sale of stage and screen rights. A lot more money. Remember, multiplied by 15. And Fitzgerald, consistent with what we know about him, spent it all. The Great Gatsby was a very disappointing front list title. Now, the first paperback edition of The Great Gatsby did not appear until 1945. I'll have a few things to say about paperbacks later. As a backlist title, though, any guesses about how The Great Gatsby is doing as a backlist title? Here's a question for you. How many copies do you think The Great Gatsby is selling a year? You're in the ballpark. 500,000 copies a year. It's a real bounty for Fitzgerald's heirs. So 500,000 copies a year. And we know where most of those 500,000 copies are being sold, too. They're being assigned to some of you, by some of you. In other words, the majority of the sales of The Great Gatsby as a backlist title are taking place in September and January, at the beginnings of semesters. So there are swells in that. If we say that that maybe it's selling 200,000 copies every fall and 200,000 copies every January, but The Great Gatsby never appears on a bestseller list, despite that large volume of sales. So think about that. Bestseller lists are like IQ tests. They both measure what they measure, and what they measure is not exactly what they purport to measure. I'm going to suggest that the tensions between what bestseller lists are and what they claim to be vibrates through both modern American literary history and the history of the best-selling novel. So some book history is in order. The whole idea of the bestseller originated in the United States, and it emerged in the postbellum period, along with it, the word bestseller. The first recorded use of the word bestseller came in an offhand reference in the Kansas Times and Star in 1889. But the second recorded use of the term by the trade magazine Bookman that is the publishing trade magazine, Bookman, in 1895, is particularly telling because it traces the early usage of the term to the publishing business itself. Bookman published the first monthly bestseller lists beginning the same year, 1895. So bestseller is both an American concept and an American word. The concept dovetails nicely with the development of what we now call the commercial book, a term that's been invented by book historians. It maybe shouldn't surprise us that the United States is where the practice of celebrating a big-selling book began, but that fact does, I think, need our notice. Nor should it surprise us that the idea of calling attention to big-selling books emerged during a period of highly self-conscious, largely unregulated industrial capitalism in this country. The bestseller list is, after all, a form of advertising, and the advertising industry grew exponentially and took on its modern form during the same period. And I might add as well, there were a great many fictions, novels, written about business during the same period. And they took pro and con positions on big business in the United States. The word bestseller has always been, above all, a marketing tool. I mentioned the novels of Horatio Alger earlier. Alger's books are familiar to us precisely because they circulated so widely, and they circulated so widely that Alger's name remains a cliché in our upward mobility lexicon, so much so that people who have never read a Horatio Alger novel know what it means when we say, oh, that's so Horatio Alger or Horatio Alger-esque. The popularity and cultural saturation of Alger's work in the period of about 1860 to 1910 was huge. It's still considerable. Yet Alger never appeared on a bestseller list. That's partly because the lists weren't around when Alger first started writing, but the last decades of Alger's career did overlap with them, and he didn't appear on them. Alger's books didn't make the bestseller list because publishers didn't want them to. That's because bestseller lists were never designed to record which books were selling the most, or at least not simply to record which books were selling the most. So here's Exhibit A. There are two lists here. One is the adult fiction list. And you can see that there are some familiar names here. Dan Brown and John Grisham are maybe not the most high-toned of literary authors, but they're certainly serious novelists. And Michael Connelly is one of the most respected crime novelists writing today. And Nora Roberts is the biggest selling author of romances. So this is a kind of list that we're used to seeing. Best-selling fiction. You see this kind of thing in the New York Times or somewhere else. But look over here on the right. The best-selling novel in the United States during October 2009, which is a month I picked more or less at random, was not Dan Brown's The Lost Symbol. It was Jeff Kinney's Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Part 4. It's a novel. Dog Days is Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Part 4. My daughter is very much into Diary of a Wimpy Kid. It's a children's book. Dan Brown is running a not very close second to Jeff Kinney. So the class component of this is fairly inescapable. That is, the Nielsen in this case, but the company that is compiling the lists wants to put together a list that grown-ups, a certain kind of book buyer, is going to respond to. They want to carve the list out so that Jeff Kinney will not appear on it. Jeff Kinney will appear on he will be the runaway number one bestseller on the children's fiction list. So This is a case of the book industry working in concert, because other best-selling other lists are similar in the way that they cut the pie up. The book industry works in concert to promote certain kinds of books in certain kinds of ways, and certain kinds of reading in certain kinds of ways. And thus
it harkens back to the how to read books that were coming out in the 1870s and 1880s, which were doing the same thing, but in a slightly different way. So
to return to Janice Radway's thesis that the Book of the Month Club created and promoted the idea of the middlebrow reader, it's important to show that the supposedly objective bestseller list likewise has the clear goal of separating out certain kinds of readers and certain kinds of reading. The Book of the Month Club is a for-profit outfit. Bestseller lists are in the service of commercial motive, too, in different ways. So let me say a few words about how bestseller lists do and don't work. First of all, they don't work by keeping track of a book's sales. At least, not exactly. Even with 21st century technology, there's no way to keep a running tally of how many copies of a given book sell from week to week. You can't simply tally copies printed. Just because the copy of a book is manufactured doesn't mean it's going to sell. Just because it's shipped to a bookstore doesn't mean it's going to sell either, because bookstores can return it if it doesn't. It can also get sold in many different ways, including wholesale and as a remainder, and in today's world as an ebook, or as a giveaway. If a store offers a free Nora Roberts romance novel to anyone who buys 4 books, how should you count that toward Nora Roberts' sales totals? So even with comprehensive information, we can only guess at a book's weekly sales figures, even if it can be a pretty good educated guess. Second, bestseller lists have never collected figures from all stores. The New York Times bestseller list, which is still the numero uno bestseller list, the one with the greatest authority, collects information from representative booksellers and chains and compiles that information according to formulas that remain a trade secret, which is worth thinking about for a moment. The New York Times bestseller list. New York Times bestsellers. You know, it's a marketing brand label that is of enormous value. That if an author makes the New York Times bestseller list, you may be sure that her next book is going to have emblazoned across the front cover New York Times bestseller. It's an article of truth in the bestselling industry. So the New York Times bestseller list has and conveys enormous authority. Even to pointy-headed literary critics like us, who think that we're above all that, New York Times bestseller. It's a pretty cool thing. But even so, we don't have any exact idea about how a book becomes a New York Times bestseller list, a New York Times bestseller. We're essentially taking the whole thing on some kind of faith. It's fairly extraordinary. We do know enough, though, that the New York Times' practice, we know that it's generally consistent with the one that was established by Bookman in the first bestseller list more than a century ago. And another point about what that means. If you buy your books from an independent bookseller, like Jeff in town, who I met a little while ago, and I'm guessing that a number of you are supporting Jeff's business, and I would if I lived here myself. If you're doing your bit to support your local independent bookseller, when you're not giving way to the ease of one-click ordering from Amazon, when you are supporting your independent bookseller, unless that independent bookseller is one of the very few who reports to the New York Times, your purchases are not affecting the bestseller lists at all. Not one wee bit. So another thought to think about, another thought when you buy your books. Third, as we've seen, the bestseller lists are not and never have been value neutral. Witness this example. The categories are constructions. And the constructions keep certain books in, and they keep certain books out. And if you collect your data only from certain points of sale, then you can exclude other books that don't get sold from those points.
The Wall Street Journal has a bestseller list, too. They collect their data almost entirely from chains. So what gets sold from an independent bookseller is not the same as the buying patterns from Walmart are not the same as the buying patterns from independent booksellers. So the Wall Street Journal's bestseller list doesn't look the same as the New York Times bestseller list in every respect. There is almost always some overlap, but there are going to be some differences because of the differences in the way that point of sale affects the outcome. Keeping that last point in mind, let us now go back in time to look at the example of the dime novel. Dime novels were a massive publishing phenomenon that started around 150 years ago and lasted into the early 20th century. They were marketed by what we now call fiction factories, such as Beadle & Company and Street & Smith. The authors, some of whom were extraordinarily prolific, wrote to specified formulas for plot and word count, and the books were mass-produced using cheap materials. Here are a couple of dime novels. You see, Beadle, the House of Beadle, was one of the most venerable of the dime novel publishers, and these are both Beadle titles. And you can get a sense of what dime novels are about from looking at these two titles, which happen to be westerns or frontier adventures. But dime novels were rollicking good stories. There's a lot to say about dime novels, and I don't want to keep you here all night. So let me present you with a few salient and related facts. Fact number one. Dime novels were rarely sold in bookstores. They were marketed through the mail and in local shops, newsstands, and such like places. Fact number two. Dime novels sold a lot of copies. No one knows precisely how many, but the most popular titles, like the Deadwood Dick series, some of you may have heard of Deadwood Dick, and the Ned Carter series, sold hundreds of thousands. Maliska is the first dime novel. It appeared in 1860. And book historians agree that Maliska sold at least 300,000 copies between 1860 and 1900. And the population of the United States between 1860 and 1900 was between 31 and 76 million, so exponentially less than today. So 300,000 copies is a very good showing for a book in any time. But when you reduce the population of the country by that level of magnitude, you get a sense of just what a big publishing success Maliska was and what a reliable source of income it was to the House of Beadle. Fact number three, dime novels attracted wide disapproval from moralists who feared that they were corrupting the morals of children, who were the targeted readers of many dime novels, and they attracted disapproval from literati who saw them as corrupting literary taste in a more general sense. Characters like Anthony Comstock, who was the head of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, and who is a very important character in the history of, among other things, contraception, as well as the history of books, was one of those who sought to suppress dime novels, so to essentially to censor them out of existence. Comstock was a postal bureaucrat, And the tools that he used to try to suppress anything was to try to restrict their being able to be sent legally through the mail. That was also how he tried to suppress contraception, which he was very successful at for many years. The
attempts at suppression
remind us, or at least they remind me, and I'm now reminding you, of the how to read books again. Because, again, the how to read books are trying to persuade people to read one way and not another. And the attempts to suppress dime novels are trying to force people to read not one way and therefore another. So there's a certain continuity here in the acts of persuasion or coercion to create reading habits of a certain kind. Fact number four. Following from facts 1 through 3, dime novels did not appear on bestseller lists. The people who made up the lists didn't want them there. Now, let's pivot to the crime novel. Dime novels gave way to pulp fiction, which was called that because the paper that it was printed on had a very high wood pulp content. It was cheap. And it felt grainy to the touch. Today's crime genre, which often seeks and sometimes attains high seriousness, evolved in the pages of dime novels, which did not seek and did not attain high seriousness. Dime novel characters like Old Sleuth and Ned Carter were among the earliest famous detectives in series fiction. Crime novels, then, started selling in great numbers as low literature. Their earliest antecedents are in true crime, starting with the so-called penny dreadfuls and other lurid pamphlet literature, and evolving into the fictional genre categories that we recognize today. Sherlock Holmes, who's a British publishing phenomenon that was very popular here, Sherlock Holmes gave a more high-toned sheen to the detective story in the late 19th century. But the reputation of genre fiction remained low for years, for decades. And that is another fact that the popularity of the how-to-read books hints at. So when the bestseller list came along in the late 19th century, crime novels did not appear on them, despite their high sales totals. But there were some important changes in the 20th century. And in particular, I want to highlight the intervention of Alfred A. Knopf in the development of hard-boiled fiction. So let me spend 30 seconds on Alfred Knopf. Knopf was one of the most famous book publishers of the 20th century, and his imprint survives today and remains synonymous with intellectual quality and prestige. It's certainly one of my ambitions someday to publish under the Knopf imprint. It's not an ambition that I necessarily expect to achieve, but it's the reputation of Knopf that leads me to have it. Knopf started his own publishing house in 1915 at a very young age. He was younger than 25. He was intellectually ambitious from the very start, and he made his first mark by traveling to Europe to sign up, then translate, and then publish European authors like Freud, Joseph Conrad, and Thomas Mann. So even though Knopf was a young upstart in the publishing business, he still had a reputation of high seriousness. But Knopf was also young, curious, and adventurous. And when he read hard-boiled crime fiction, and in contrast to today, publishers actually read the books that they published, and they had relationships with the authors who they published. So Knopf read hard-boiled crime fiction, and he was interested in publishing it as a way of staking a claim that crime literature could be something more than a dime novel in clean clothes. The hard-boiled style, which features tough and laconic, detached protagonists and a very bleak view of the world, had been evolving through the 1920s in the pages of the pulp magazines.
Most notably, Black Mask, which was edited by the legendary Joseph Shaw, and Shaw published most of the first generation of hardboiled writers during the 20s. Pulps, by the way, paid authors a nickel a word. The more high-priced magazines, which were then called slicks, paid about a dollar a word. So you get a sense of how little the writers of pulp fiction were toiling for. Dashiell Hammett, who is the best of the first generation of hard-boiled pulp magazine writers, wrote that he wanted to take the detective story, Hammett wrote. He said he wanted to take it and make literature of it, which is a pretty ambitious claim for pulp fiction. So, and Knopf took him on. Hammett wrote four novels in a burst beginning in the late 20s. The Red Harvest, The Dane Curse, The Glass Key, and The Maltese Falcon. They're all crime literature classics. The Maltese Falcon, in particular, is one of the ur books of the genre. And together, these novels make a case for Hammett as one of the most influential writers in the history of American literature, because those four books essentially reinvented the crime literature in the United States. So Knopf was making a very important intervention here, because crime was a popular genre then as now. Knopf also published James M. Cain, whose first novel, The Postman Always Rings Twice, made something of a kerfluffle when it appeared in 1934 over its sexual frankness. Together, these set the stage for Raymond Chandler. So the story I'm about to tell now about Raymond Chandler, you could call it the alchemy of a bestseller. It has its own sense of mystery. Like Hammett, Chandler started out writing for Black Mask. But Chandler started out about a decade later than Hammett. He was not a first-generation hardboiled writer. Although Chandler was a few years older than Hammett, he was slower to get started. When Knopf discovered Chandler, in turn, in the late 30s, and decided to publish him, hardboiled writing had already gained some cachet, although it was hardly seen as highbrow literature. But Knopf believed in Chandler, and he published Chandler's debut novel, The Big Sleep, as an in-house imprint, as a Borzoi book, in 1939. The Big Sleep introduces Philip Marlowe, the detective character that Chandler had been honing in the pulps. In The Big Sleep, Marlowe takes this very self-conscious opening bow where he dresses up in the opening moments of the first book, dresses in his best suit to go and meet an aristocratic gentleman. We get a sense that what Chandler is doing here is introducing the character to everybody else, too. And in the movie that was made of The Big Sleep, that scene is really beautifully recreated. Here's the hardback of The Big Sleep. It's, as you can see, it is a very restrained presentation. Though that red river of blood is noticeable to somebody who's read the book, if you haven't read the book, it's not necessarily recognizable. The Big Sleep sold for $2. Again, worth about $30. Inflation was not then what it has been at different times since. And the American sales were 12,500, with a few thousand more in Great Britain. A disappointing performance, and also one that, at 15% royalties, did not bring Chandler very much money. Perhaps, $2,000 or so. The Knopf published an in-house paperback, which cost a dollar, a lot of money for a paperback, which sold only 3,500 more copies. Chandler's royalty rate on that paperback was only 5%, so he only made $175 from it. So Knopf wasn't exactly doing very well with this either. Now, at this time, the paperback industry was starting to rise, but Knopf did not
sell Chandler's books into paperback, because he believed in Chandler, as I said before, and for a book to go into the to be sold into paperback was a kiss of literary death to its author. If Chandler, the paperbacks were known as pulp books at the time, and for an author to be known as an author of pulp books meant that any claims he might have to literary seriousness were gone. And so Knopf, along with Chandler believed very strongly in himself, and Knopf believed in what Chandler was doing, so he resisted selling the big Sleep into paperback, even though it had performed poorly, because Knopf had a stake in Chandler and encouraged him to keep going. So Chandler did, and he published Farewell, My Lovely in 1940, and it did worse. Again, a few thousand copies more in Great Britain. And Chandler, at this point, is eating cheap meat and living in one shabby apartment after another with his wife and wondering how the hell he's going to make it. 1942, Chandler publishes The High Window, does even worse. Although better in Great Britain. And so things are looking pretty bad. And the what happened at this point, if you were sold into paperback, one of the consequences of being sold into paperback was that you would never get reviewed in the serious publications and never get any of the sales that might come from being reviewed. But the problem here is that Chandler wasn't getting reviewed anyway, so which was contributing, among other things, to the low sales holds. And so after these, The Big Sleep was, you might say, strike one. Farewell, My Lovely, strike two. The High Window, strike three, and Chandler was out. Knopf, as much as he liked Chandler's work, said, okay. He sold The Big Sleep to paperback, to Avon Books, to be precise. Now, this was on the strength that Knopf had spent a fair bit of money to promote The High Window, and to have such a big advertising campaign fall essentially flat on its face was really part of what contributed to the strike three. And Knopf gave up his high hopes for Chandler, and the sale of The Big Sleep to paperback occurred in 1943, shortly before Chandler's fourth novel, The Lady in the Lake, was set to appear. So, then some interesting things happened. Before I talk about them, though, I'd like to look at the paperback edition of The Big Sleep and compare that cover to the hardback edition with its restraint. You can see here that a different kind of reader is being appealed to, that complete and unexpurgated, the hardback was also unexpurgated, but Avon Books wants to brag about it being unexpurgated to suggest that there might be something that somebody might want to expurgate. There isn't really, although there is a used condom in the Big Sleep. You have to read pretty closely to catch it. There's a sense of the lurid. There is also a sense of the cheap. If you look up a $2 mystery for 25 cents, the imprint Murder Mystery Monthly, I think, speaks for itself. So the royalty rate for the Avon paperback was standard $750 to the author per 100,000 copies sold. So that's a royalty rate on a 25-cent price of 3%. So nobody's going to get rich selling paperbacks in the 1940s. Nevertheless, and the Big Sleep, the paperback edition of The Big Sleep sold like crazy. 300,000 copies. And in addition, there was an armed services paperback edition. The books that were being sent to our boys fighting overseas, those books were just the right size to fit in the pocket of a uniform, And the history of the armed services paperback industry is very interesting in its own way. A group of publishers, a consortium of publishers, got together to decide which titles would be sent abroad. And some of them were classic novels like Vanity Fair, and some of them were crime genre paperbacks like The Big Sleep. This is the complete book, not a digest. You know, some of the same ideas are in place here. The Armed Services paperback edition of The Big Sleep sold like crazy. Suddenly, Chandler has nearly 500,000 copies in print. And this starts a causal chain of great importance for Chandler's reputation and the way we understand Chandler today. The success of the paperback leads to critical reviews for The Lady in the Lake, which, remember, comes out just at about the same time. That's Chandler's fourth novel. So the critical reviews that Chandler had not been receiving, now he starts to receive. And The Lady in the Lake does better than before. The aggregate, 14,000 in the United States plus 13,000 in Great Britain, he's doing very well now. The reviews of The Lady in the Lake lead in turn to Chandler getting a job writing screenplays in Hollywood, for which he starts to be paid initially $750 a week. Big money in the Depression. And remember, you get $750 for each 100,000 copies of that paperback of The Big Sleep. Now he's getting $750 a week. So his financial problems are now in the past. And his first job is to co-write the screenplay for Double Indemnity, James Cain's novel, and with Billy Wilder. And Double Indemnity was made into one of the greatest film noirs ever. And if you haven't seen it, you should go see it. Cain himself said that it was brought to the screen better than he wrote it. The Chandler received a lot of praise and for that screenplay, and his reputation in Hollywood soared. He was already living in California. He was a Los Angelino. This Chandler's success in Hollywood led to Hollywood adaptations of Chandler's own work, notably Murder, My Sweet, which was a version of Farewell, My Lovely, with the old song and dance man Dick Powell reviving his own career, playing Philip Marlowe. It's a good movie. And The Big Sleep, which is legendary, with Humphrey Bogart playing Marlowe, igniting sparks on screen with Lauren Bacall. And The Big Sleep is also on the short list of great film noir ever. So the Hollywood adaptations lead in turn, synergistically, to more reviews and more paperback sales of earlier Chandler titles, which Knopf dutifully sold into paperback, and more adaptations. So Chandler, at this point, is riding a wave. By the mid-40s, his wallet had become fat, his reputation had gone sky high, and it was rising. Soon Chandler's reputation transcended his genre. And the genre itself, within the crime genre, suddenly dozens of writers were trying to imitate Chandler, creating characters who resembled Philip Marlowe in this or that important way. So Chandler, in the course of under a decade, went from somebody who was trying to avoid being seen as a hack to an artist of the first rank, and an artist whose star was pulling up the reputation of the whole genre he was writing in along with him. So the key link in the chain is the success of the paperback edition of The Big Sleep. That's the event that got the ball rolling. So why did The Big Sleep succeed as a paperback after the hardback flopped? And here I'm going to give a very technical answer that's grounded in years of study of crime novels and book history. Who the hell knows? It's one of the mysteries of the book business. Remember that I described Chandler's career as a case of alchemy. Why Chandler?
Why then? We can only speculate. My own speculation is this. Chandler's overt sentimentality not only separated him from many of his peers, but also took the hard-boiled style in a direction that it was straining to go in already, and it was a direction that Hammett and Cain had already pointed toward. The Big Sleep has many of the qualities of a sentimental novel. A broken family, a wayward daughter, two of them in this case, and a parent whose rectitude stands as a beacon rooted in the virtuous past. Chandler's method of writing the qualities of the sentimental novel into the tough guy duck detective story, starting with his own hard-boiled sentimental detective, Philip Marlowe, provided a template for hard-boiled writers by the score. Chandler's influence, as I've already said, was huge on the writers who followed him. But his example also shows, in its entirety, the range of possibilities that remained and still remain for a crime writer in America. Chandler's career spans the possibilities from literary fiction to mass market paperbacks, with the wild card of the movies thrown in. Now I'm going to end by talking about two pairs of American crime writers who illustrate the opposite sides of the divide which Chandler embodies in his own career. Here is the first pair. So Patricia Highsmith and Jim Thompson were contemporaries. They never met, and in many ways you could say they never could meet. Highsmith was a literary craftswoman who wrote the bulk of her first novel, Strangers on a Train, at the very prestigious writer's colony, Yaddo. She got her residency at Yaddo in part because of a recommendation by Truman Capote. And while she was at Yaddo, she met Flannery O'Connor, who also wrote some of her most famous work at Yaddo. The Strangers on a Train, like all of Highsmith's novels, was published first in hardback. And when it was optioned by Alfred Hitchcock, he commissioned Raymond Chandler to write the screenplay. It didn't go well. Chandler complained a lot. And eventually Hitchcock fired him and hired somebody else to finish it. The image here is of Highsmith's most famous novel, and also her best novel, I think, The Talented Mr. Ripley, which came out in 1955. It's a great book. I'm not going to talk about it today, but you know, if you haven't read it, you should read it. Highsmith had published not only Strangers on a Train, but also The Blunderer, and also, in 1952, under a pseudonym, one of the classics of gay fiction in the 50s, The Price of Salt. But her authorship of that didn't become known until years later. But you can see that the cover of The Talented Mr. Ripley is very restrained. It's the kind of book cover that could easily appear on the coffee table of somebody who wants her visitors to believe that she's reading serious fiction. Nothing untoward about it. On the other hand, Thompson's The Killer Inside Me would not go so well on the same coffee table. You can see the pool of blood underneath the woman's body, and there is a sense of impending murder, and the legend across the top, "You see, I had to destroy them." It's a novel of murder unlike any you've ever read, whereas about The Talented Mr. Ripley, only a novel of suspense. That's the reason why Highsmith and Thompson could never meet. The visual style of these covers show how their stories are being marketed very differently. But both of these stories are stories of serial murderers by authors who much preferred to tell the story from the point of view of the murderer rather than of the police or the detective who's chasing the murderer. And those stories, a story that's told from the point of view of the criminal,
is bound to be a lot more risky, a lot more disturbing, and a lot more jangly and unstable. Thompson and Highsmith have quite a bit in common, in fact.
Both Thompson and Highsmith wrote with great literary complexity. Thompson, despite appearing in 25-cent paperbacks, was a latter-day modernist who created some of the most indeterminate crime stories that exist in the whole genre. And those stories have been recognized since. Now, Thompson way outsold Highsmith. But Thompson's books were what were called
paperback originals. That is, there were no hardbacks. Thompson wrote directly for paperback.
And his books regularly sold more than 200,000 copies, did not appear on bestseller lists. And between 1952 and 1954, Thompson wrote 13 books and received almost no recognition and made very little money. When his publisher, Lion Books, you see, a Lion Book. When Lion Books stopped publishing paperback originals and Thompson's editor moved to California, Thompson lost his perch and his career started to spiral downward slowly.
Both Thompson and Highsmith have enjoyed magnificent afterlives. They've
received loving attention from meticulous biographers. And a new biography of Highsmith came out just about a month ago. It's really great. And their books are now seen as literature, but neither of them lived to see that day. This pair of writers, the last one I'm going to look at, widens the divide. Ross MacDonald was one of Knopf's most successful later discoveries in the hard-boiled crime field. MacDonald was always trying to write literature. His aspirations were very high. His stories were labyrinthine explorations of crime as sin, and a sin that gets buried in families, with the detective as a kind of genealogist who has to reconstruct broken and lost family ties and in order to dig out the crime that happened usually many years ago. Spillane, on the other hand, is slam bang. But MacDonald is delicately psychological, clearly a reader of Freud, and his detective, Lou Archer, is very reluctant to throw a punch. After about a decade and a half of moderate success writing that way, MacDonald broke through, not by doing anything different, but by being discovered and by having the right fans, including Eudora Welty. MacDonald broke through, and he joined Hammett and Chandler as the only crime writers to transcend the genre in their own time. MacDonald received front page coverage in the New York Times Book Review, and he was on the cover of Newsweek in 1971. When's the last time you can remember a novelist being on the cover of Newsweek, let alone a crime novelist? In both cases, in many others, MacDonald was being hailed as a great novelist. Period. Not a great crime novelist, but a great novelist. And his respectability, which was enabled by Chandler before him and others, allowed MacDonald to take the detective story to literary Olympus for a little while. His reputation has gone down since. And he widened the way that Hammett and Chandler helped to pave. Crime stories, though, remain the stuff of the sensational even today. Many of them still come out as paperback originals, and lots of them appeal more to prurient interest than refined literary sensibility. Since MacDonald, though, there's been wider critical latitude to view crime stories as serious and ambitious art. So even though critics like me don't think MacDonald's books are as good as critics of 1969 did, he remains a very important figure in the story of how crime fiction became respectable. Mickey Spillane, on the other hand, devised a whole new marketing plan for writers. Spillane never aspired to hardcover respectability. He went directly to the paperback market on purpose. He wanted to sidestep critical opinion. He didn't like critics, and he didn't trust them to view his books in any kind of positive way. And in fact, the critics hated his books. And he aimed for a different kind of reader.
I, the Jury, was
Spillane's first novel. And it's, like its successors, it's a pretty overdrawn version of hard-boiled fiction with Mike Hammer as his detective. And Mike Hammer is a hyper-masculine avenger and a violent defender of American culture as he, Mike Hammer, sees it. As the cover suggests here,
everything in Spillane's world is black and white, except blood. There is very little ambiguity in a Spillane novel,
and no one has ever tried to sell Spillane as literature. But Spillane was very successful at what he did. By the early 1960s, Spillane's worldwide sales totaled over 70 million copies. By 1990, that number had doubled to about 150 million, more than doubled. In this century, the quoted number of Spillane copies in print is over 200 million. In 1967, a list was published of all-time best-selling books published in the United States between 1895 and 1965. Seven of the top 10 were Spillane novels. At about that time, according to Spillane, and now this is Spillane's version of the story, some New York literary type guy walks up to me and says, "I think it's disgraceful that of the top 10 best-selling books of all time, seven were written by you." And Spillane supposedly replied to this, "You're lucky I've only written seven books and not three more." On that note, I'm going to wrap this up. And I'm going to do that by noting two facts that encompass the vexed and variable quality of bestsellerness that I've been talking about tonight, and also the upward mobility of the crime genre within literary history and the history of bookselling. The two facts are these. Not only did Ross Macdonald make the New York Times bestseller list, but so did Mickey Spillane. Thanks.
We will now begin the question and answer session. If you do have a question, please raise your hand and wait for a microphone to reach you before beginning to speak.
Oh, come on. Have at it.
So, in terms of, first of all, were Chandler's next three books, were they all the same protagonist?
Yes. Chandler's short stories. Let me back up a bit. Chandler's career bifurcates. So does Hammett. That is, Chandler wrote short stories, and then he wrote novels. Hammett wrote short stories, and then he wrote novels. Both Chandler and Hammett, once they started writing novels, they each saw their career as, in effect, starting over again. And so in their lifetimes, neither Chandler nor Hammett collected the short stories that they wrote for the pulp magazines. It was as though they saw those stories as constituting an apprenticeship about which they would as soon forget. The stories have been collected since, with an exception. Chandler used his short stories as raw material for some of his novels. He would combine them and choose elements from them, and he called this cannibalizing. Now, Chandler's short stories, some of them were about Philip Marlowe, some of them were not. But you could see Chandler experimenting with character. And by the time he emerged as a novelist, and again, I want to emphasize that he was doing this, it was a self-conscious debut, a rebirth of sorts. He only wrote about Marlowe. Marlowe was a combination of qualities that Chandler feared in himself, because Marlowe could be very dour and tended toward the alcoholic, which Chandler also did. But Marlowe was also had qualities that Chandler aspired to in himself. That is, Marlowe was a virtuous man, a mensch, if you want. And so Chandler never felt comfortable when he was away from Marlowe, at least as a fiction writer under his own name. Now, this, of course, excludes the screenplays. But Chandler's screenplays were exclusively adaptations. He never wrote an original screenplay, and so where he made up the characters. So you could say when Chandler was developing his own fiction, as in his own mind, as a novelist, as a writer of high seriousness, his work was only about Marlowe.
The only thing I'd say after that is it your view then that even though it's maybe a little bit formulaic, I haven't read the other three books or any of the short stories, obviously, but the fact that it's does that take away from the fact that it's literature or not in any way, in your opinion?
Well, you know, I have a hard time. I think, you know, as somebody who studies genre fiction, and I study it because I like it, and I've been taught high literature like many of you have, maybe all of you. I think I have a hard time making the decisions about what is literature and what isn't. The Moby Dick did pretty badly when it was first published. I think that's a pretty famous literary failure. And one of the reasons that Moby Dick did badly is because Melville's readership was conditioned to expect a different kind of book. That Melville was, by the standards of his own time and by the categories of his own time, a genre writer. During the 1840s, Melville wrote novels of the sea. Now, maritime romances are a mostly eclipsed genre. The Patrick O'Brien certainly is a notable exception, but an exception is what he is. We don't see the novel of the sea as a category of the same kind of importance that readers of the 1840s would have seen it as, and there are reasons for that. 1840s readers could not easily travel from one place to another, let alone across an ocean. Most people lived their lives within a small number of miles of where they were born. And travel literature was, in the 19th century, a much more popular and important literary category than it is today, in part for that reason, because people couldn't travel themselves. And maritime romances were a hugely popular literary category because the kind of imaginative transport that they offered was one which people may have perceived greater need for at the time. So Melville, who was himself a sailor for a number of years, as many of you will know, started out as a very popular author of light and lively novels of the sea. And that was his readership. He was a well-known writer, a bestseller of his time, although there were the categories were not collected. And so, but Moby Dick does not fit the genre. It's a very unsatisfying book if what you're looking for is a fast-moving genre fiction that provides a certain kind of action and a certain kind of resolution. And Melville's readership reacted pretty violently. And including reviewers, the book tanked. Today we have a somewhat different view of it, and we have a somewhat different view of everything Melville ever touched than in that time. And one of the reasons that Melville biographies are so shadowy is because at the time that he died, he was still obscure, and so people threw all his stuff out, and there was no reason to save it. And so now his biographies tend to be conjectural. So, you know, we look at Moby Dick and say, oh, you know, Moby Dick is great literature, which is what Melville intended for it in the first place. But 19th century readers had a different idea. And so here I'm sitting in the 21st century, and you're asking me a good question. You know, what do I think about the literary value of crime novels or of Chandler's novels in general? And my somewhat weaselly answer is that whatever I would tell you now isn't necessarily what people will say 100 years from now, with the same kind of certainty that I could say something now. So The literature is a category that is, I think, always going to have squishy boundaries. It is very clear that certain crime novels are more serious in their intent than other crime novels. It's also true that some of the better crime novelists try to escape the genre because they want to do different things, like Dennis Lehane, who started out as a genre writer but is now doing something that's rather different and more expansive. So I'm rather than answer your question yes or no, I'm going to give it a big maybe like that.
Hi. I was wondering, you talked a little bit about the bestseller list from, I think it was October 2009, mm-hmm. And mentioned some of the authors. I was wondering what you, as well as sort of the greater literary society, consider those novels to be sort of the higher, more serious works or the lower, not as serious pieces, and then whether or not there could be, you know, a book that was higher and serious and more of like a literature book that would be still a bestseller.
Well, I'll answer the last part of your question first. Toni Morrison writes books of high seriousness that make the bestseller list for short periods of time, but they do make the bestseller list. And Toni Morrison is one of the most canonical writers we have, and certainly one of the most canonical living. That would be an example. So-called literary fiction can be best-selling fiction, although not always. And Morrison does very well on the basis partly of past recognition. But if we go to this list, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to out some of your teachers here. We don't read a whole lot of contemporary fiction, many of us. So those of us who actively write about it and teach it, of course, are an exception. But I read the contemporary fiction I like. My teaching portfolio doesn't include the most contemporary stuff. And so have not read most of what appears here. I read a James Patterson novel as part of research for my book, thought it was quite dreadful. I've read John Grisham, also for my book, thought he was quite dreadful too. But Grisham has has tried to do some more complex things since he first started out. I will out myself and say that although I intend to, I have not read The Da Vinci Code. I'm thinking that may put me in a minority in this audience. I did read a Nora Roberts novel as part of research for my book. I didn't think she was dreadful, but I didn't find her very compelling either. Michael Connelly I like. I think he's very interesting. And I find it pretty remarkable that he can publish as much as he does with and at that level of complexity. But I'm gonna say a qualified I don't know to your question, because my reading in the stuff that comes out today is pretty patchy. I think my daughter would to be able to tell you some things about Diary of a Wimpy Kid though, but I haven't read those, and she doesn't keep them around.
Do you have any thoughts about the legitimization of comics as literature?
Well, yes, I do. But I think that Professor Ball probably has a few more than I do. But it's pretty monumental, and it's a real growth phenomenon that graphic versions of best-selling novels are coming out in profusion. It's a really sort of happening field. I don't know what to say about that, but I would say that the the combination of word and image is something that we can, if we couldn't predict it, and it's hard to predict things like this, we can certainly see it as a logical enough outcome of a culture that is relying increasingly on the combination of word and image to deliver information through the internet. And some of the the more ambitious examples of graphic narrative, I understand that you've had here not only Alison Bechdel but Art Spiegelman. That stuff to me is hugely compelling. I love those books. I thought that that Fun Home was a really terrific book, and I think Mouse is one of the best books of the last 50 years. So and in large part because of the way that the combination of word and image creates not only new things to think about, but new things to talk about. And the I've been teaching Mouse myself for a while, and I really like the discussions that the book creates in my class, in part because of the new paths that they go down. So it's exciting. It'd be interesting to see where it all goes.
Could you talk about the relationship between sort of bestsellerdom and seriality? Because I assume the Diary of a Wimpy Kid is like fourth in a series.
Yeah.
Or even
the
sort of branding of the James Pattersons and the John Grishams and what the relationship is.
I think that there's an obvious aspect of seriality that I'm going to take a guess and say that, like me, you. You all had your own experience with series when you were young. Now, in my case, I, in some ways, have never outgrown that. But some people do. But I think that my daughter loves series, and they're a very comfortable reading experience for her. And series characters and detectives are very notable example of series characters. Well, I will first say that they can get tired. Robert B. Parker died a couple of weeks ago. How many of you have read anything by Robert B. Parker? Okay, a couple. He's sold quite a few millions of books, but apparently not to many of you. But I was a Robert B. Parker. Addict would be too strong a word. I didn't feel that I didn't need to read every book, and two or three of them came out a year. I think I regarded Robert B. Parker as something of a guilty pleasure, and I think part of the reason that it was a guilty pleasure was because Parker exemplifies some of the more disreputable aspects of seriality. That he uses, he relies so much on the time-worn reference to bring back everything, that you wind up falling into well-worn grooves, and your reading experience becomes safe and easy. And if you're dealing with bestsellerness needs to be approachable, and if you are into a series, that is the ultimate in approachability. But there was a phenomenon in the dime novels, which here I give credit to Bill Brown, who's a really notable critic of the material culture in the 19th century. He was looking at dime westerns, and a lot of dime novels were westerns. And he's tracing, not all of them were series. He notes that as from the beginning of dime novels, which their approximately 50-year run, Westerns were popular from the start, and the description of scenery in Westerns, in dime Westerns, decreases decade by decade, until by the end of the run of dime novels, dime Westerns have almost no description of scenery at all. They're almost all dialogue and character driven. The reasoning being, and Brown argues, and I would agree, that everyone knows the scenery already because they've read other dime novels. And so there's a decadence to this that is that I can't believe is terribly productive for the mind of the reader, that one falls into cliched reading habits, cliched thinking. It is possible to keep a series fresh, but it's an interesting writerly challenge. And if you're a reader, it's an interesting readerly challenge to how you're going to keep it fresh as well. And when I was reading from series in order to write my book, one thing that I did was I would never read two books in a row by the same author, because they would collapse into each other. And so I would bounce from series to series, author to author, in order to try to keep my own thought process to be flowing clearly and originally, which, you know, I hope it worked. I think it's a pretty good book.
We have time for one more question.
Or not.
I misunderstood, but I thought a theme of your talk this evening was that the crime novel has had a kind of a tough row to hoe in the sense of the way people were taught to read in the past and the way publishers wanted to package their bestseller list and that sort of thing. But when you look back more cross-culturally and historically, crime has always been a kind of fascinating topic for even high literature. So I was wondering how you could... Dostoevsky is the guy that comes to my mind. Mm-hmm. But there are other people.
Dreiser.
Yeah, you could talk about. So is it the crime novel that you're talking about, or is it certain features of the contemporary crime novel that you find to be somehow distinctive, or is it only limited to the American culture?
Important to talk about this. The distinction I think that is important to make, not simply for you, but as a general matter, is between crime and detective genre and fiction about crime. Now let's take the detective story. The detective stories are as old as time. The Oedipus is a detective story. Oedipus is the detective. He's seeking a criminal. It happens to be himself, which he learns that. But you have all of the kind of moments of revelation that you expect in a detective novel. But of course, besides being a play, we don't think of Oedipus as a detective story, because the category didn't exist in whatever 1000 BC Sophocles was writing the play. We give Poe credit, Edgar Allan Poe, credit for inventing the detective story, because even though Poe did not by any means write the first detective story, he invented the formula for the detective genre as we know it in the three stories that he wrote about the detective Auguste Dupin. That if you go and read any of those stories, you'll recognize not only similarities with Sherlock Holmes, but with any detective story you've ever read since, if it was a fairly conventional detective story. Because Poe invented the formula, and for that he deserves his fair credit. So the distinction, crime, as you suggest, crime has always been a subject for authors of high seriousness, and both of true authors who are writing about actual true crimes or imagined crimes. It's a very powerful subject because it's murder in particular is a social transgression of considerable note that can generate a lot of literary machination and deep thought. But what I've been talking about mostly tonight is the career of the crime genre as originally invented by Poe, but from which it migrated into very sort of low quality, low reputation periodicals. And Poe was, although Poe fancied himself as we fancy him today, as a literary giant, he was surely not seen as that in his own time, and he was in his own time a magazine writer. So he was a kind of pulp fictionist in his own time. So crime started out, the crime genre had low origins, and it has had a fairly successful career, although its connections to its low origins are still highly visible. If we compare it, though, to romance, the romance has had a much tougher time establishing itself as a genre of high seriousness. Romance novels are they sell in huge numbers. They outsell crime novels. They outsell mysteries on every level. They publishers love them. They are their franchise material. But romance is not typically taken seriously. Now I am editing an omnibus history of the American novel that will come out in about a year. It has in it the first chapter ever in a history of the American novel devoted to romance fiction. And it isn't so much because I think that romance novels are a form of high literature that we have yet to discover, so much as that I think, going back to the first question and thereby segueing from beginning to end in a most elegant way, I think that it's very difficult for us to understand the flow of literature without when we try to separate high from low, and that a history of the American novel, a history of any literature, I think needs to take note of those different categories, but always alongside each other and in combination with each other, because the career of a book or the career of a genre or the career of a literature can be very dynamic. And then those kinds of dynamics are, I think, central to what we as literary critics and literary historians ought to be doing.
This concludes the end of our program. Thank you for coming, and have a nice evening.